Natural Resources for Monday, May 7th, 2007. Open our first public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, the Department of Fish and Wildlife Budget Bill. As you can see, they seem to all come in right at the moment that the gavel's dropped. Mr. Siebert, do you want to start?
Mr. Chairman, I would just note that the you were delivered your presentation notebook last week, and also the department has provided a copy of the slides that they'll be going through the next couple of days.
Okay.
And I believe the director, Virgil Moore, is here to begin the presentation.
Okay. Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's really good to be here on a Monday morning, bright and early. We have some slides that we're going to use to walk through some of the early portions of the budget book that you have. Many of the slides correspond to about the first 20, 30 pages of that book, but I'm going to use those to prompt my discussions and comments to you as we get going here this morning. I'm Virgil Moore. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And this is my first opportunity to present a budget to this committee, and I'm looking forward to that.
For the sake of time, just because in one previous occasion, someone that thought that this committee goes to 10:30, technically it goes to 10, and since the presiding officer of the House has decided that they have to be in session at 10, I usually close the committee at about 9:50 each morning. So,
Mr. Chairman, we will keep it crisp and to the point.
Not the presenters, it's usually us that derail.
I want to start off real quick with the statutory authority. Like most state agencies, we have a public trust that was passed to the state of statehood from the federal government, and the Oregon statutes outline the agency's responsibility for managing fish and wildlife under that public trust. These are the state has two primary wildlife policies that are in code, the wildlife policy and the food fish policy. Food fish includes salmon in this particular case, whereas wildlife are all other freshwater fish and terrestrial animals. Both of these policies are very similar, and the components of them that I think are very important for us to focus on is that they talk about recreational, economic, commercial, aesthetic benefits. They talk about optimizing those, not maximizing them. And they talk about present and future generations. Really, in a succinct manner, what we're talking about is sustainability of fish and wildlife resources for today and tomorrow. And that is reflected to a large degree in the agency's mission that has been developed from these statutory policies that we operate under. And that is, we'll protect and enhance the fish and wildlife and their habitats for use and enjoyment by present and future generations. So we're going to do this for today and tomorrow. And it's a common thread with all fish and wildlife agencies, which is sustainability. We can't take more than we can use safely and still not have it available tomorrow. Some of the agency principles that we'll be talking about over the next few days that are important to us, and I think very important to our public out there, and this committee is more than keenly aware of them, are things like fiscal integrity. We've got to be sure that every dollar that we spend is spent properly. We need to promote workforce enhancement. I'll be talking about that a little bit more later. We're going to work on proactive, solution-based fish management. We want to have effective relationships. I think this is one of the most important. Trust and confidence in program leaders is key to getting anything done. The integrity of the staff, the integrity of the programs, the integrity of the science, since we're a science-based management organization, is key. And we need to work within the organization and outside of the organization as a team. These are important principles. They've been in effect in this agency for a number of years. We're going to continue to emphasize those, and you'll see that emphasis in the budget as we work through it. Quickly, the agency organization. And in your larger handout on page, flip through my notes here so I know where I'm at. Page 3, you'll have a slide there too that talks about the leadership and shows the photos of the commission. Fish and Wildlife Commission, 7 members, 1 from each of the 5 congressional districts, 2 at large, east and west of the Cascades. They serve staggered 4-year terms. They're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Fairly standard operation among most of the states, particularly the western states. The director, in my case, I serve at the pleasure of the commission. And hired by them and work basically as staff for the commission with the responsibilities of the executive branch through the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have 2 deputy directors, Lori Byerly, who's sitting next to me here, and Roy Ellicker, who I know all of you know by now, and I have always known, is over the Fish and Wildlife Program. We have a number of statutory divisions and functions in the agency that are reflected in our organization. And I will note at the very bottom of the screen down here is that the enforcement function of the agency is fulfilled by Oregon State Police and their Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Program under Captain Marquis's leadership. And that is a very strong relationship we have. It's key to the management of the state, and we'll be talking more about the needs of that program as we proceed.
Virgil, I have a quick question. In the presentation notebook, you have listed the number of FTEs.
Yes.
Does that include the state police or no?
Representative, no, it does not. The state police number is included in their program budget, and I believe it numbers 119 at this point, somewhere in that range. Captain Marquis will be here later, and he can address those. Our geographic service delivery is via 4 regions, and if you quickly, on the map here, as you look at it, you'll see the blue area is the northwest region. It has 2 watersheds. The high desert region is a huge piece of real estate. It's kind of this pink tan, and it has 3 watersheds. It spans everything from the Dalles clear over to Ontario and down into the Owyhees. The southwest region has 2 watersheds, and then the northwest region, 3 watersheds. We typically have offices in each of those watersheds, as well as the regional office that you'll note via the little triangle here that delivers that. And we have regional managers that oversee those operations with a watershed biologist over each of the watersheds and staff hierarchically structured underneath that. At one point in time, the state had 6 regions, but they've been reduced to 4 for administrative purposes, and currently we operate. I will point out we do have a fairly large marine program. It takes in all of the territorial waters as well as a lot of the marine management in conjunction with National Marine Fisheries Service that's in Newport. And so we maintain a full service office in Newport that meets a lot of the needs of the commercial fishing as well as the sport fishing and shell fishing publics. Some of the key issues that we're dealing with in this budget is the Oregon Coastal Cohort Recovery. The Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is a key document for use in this state, as all of you are aware. We just had the coastal coho plan was approved last year. It helped keep coho off the endangered species list. This effort, as well as the upturn in populations, was key to that. Continuing funding and monitoring coho, as well as implementation of the Oregon plan, will be significant. We had a lot of the monies for this from Measure 36 from the lottery funds. 7.5% of the lottery funds go to the Oregon plan through OWEB, and much of that money comes back to benefit the habitat and fish and wildlife, or the fish, particularly in this case. Other key issues we have is the Oregon Conservation Strategy. Many of you, as I've made the rounds, have gotten and received this document. That's just the short version of what is the plan. The Oregon Conservation Strategy was mandated by Congress that we come up with state conservation strategies to get federal funds, that we match with state funds to do essentially wildlife diversity or non-game management of and habitats for all other species out there that aren't covered. And it provides a blueprint for voluntary actions as well as a foundation, as we're going to be talking about, for funding in the future. I think that's going to help non-game and habitats for all species. Cougars. We've had a cougar plan that was approved last year, 2006. Our cougar numbers are up, predominantly as a result of, I think, Measure 18, where we had some changes in hunting practices. And current sport hunting is not large enough in many areas to keep cougar populations in check with the habitat and prey base or with the growing human population that's out there. And we have a number of management actions that have been approved by the commission that are underway right now to look at adaptive management using administrative take, in other words, our staff, and some of the federal agencies, to work at reducing populations into management goal ranges and then monitoring the effects on human conflicts, on livestock. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Moore. I knew when we got to cougars we'd get a question, so Representative Garrard.
Virgil, is the increase in cougar numbers due to migration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard. Some, but mostly it is an expansion of the population due to reduced mortality on those animals that have occurred, and then as they reduce the mortality, we see juvenile cougars migrating, particularly young males, migrating out and wandering around. And so there is an expansion component, but it's due to the lower mortality and high productivity of those core populations.
Thank you.
Yes.
Before we get into a larger discussion about cougars, if the committee is headed that way, I don't understand how it relates to your budget. So could you just give me a real thumbnail sketch on the topic and the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Avakian, we have to budget money to manage these animals and take to achieve the management goals. We're having to dedicate staff and resources to either taking these animals, managing and monitoring them above what we've had in the past, particularly where we have increasing conflicts with the public. We're having to dedicate more and more of our resources to dealing with those conflicts where we don't have, where we have growing populations. The Bend area is a good example.
So are you asking for more FTE specifically for the Cougar Management Plan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Avakian, I don't believe so.
And I understand that you have a budget for the program, but is that changing somehow this time because of the increased population that you're talking about?
Chairman, Senator Avakian, I'm going to have to defer to staff on that one. I don't know whether we have a large expansion or not. And I can get that answer if you want. So, no, we do not.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to kind of follow up, there is a budget issue, at least I think there is from my part of the country. Like Alloa County, there used to be 4,000 elk tags. Now there's 400 or something. I don't know what those figures are. But it's mainly in some, there's some allegation that the drop in your revenue from the sale of tags is due to cougar predation on elk, so you don't have as much elk. Is there any truth to that? Does that go to Senator Larkin's question at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, there are elk herd productivity issues. Some of that is related to predation in certain specific areas. There's a tremendous amount of evaluation going on with elk herd productivity and survival of young of the year calves through their first winter. And we have seen in certain areas of the state fairly high levels of that first year mortality are related to predation of various types, and cougars are a component of that. And so consequently, the answer is yes, there have to be reductions in permits and hunting opportunities to be sure that we don't over-harvest and sustain those elk herds.
Mr. Chair, one representative.
Representative Clement.
Yeah, just related to the, you know, the budget side of this, we've got a bill moving through the, I think it's not to the House floor, but probably will be this week, related to allowing volunteers to become agents, both in the Cougar Management Plan and in the just general take. It looked to me in the budget notebook somewhere I saw that the, you know, initial implementation of the Cougar Management Plan would be done by agency staff. So I guess what the question then would become was, at some point, if the bill passed, became law, and we were able to get back to the 94 to 99 sort of time period of using volunteers to do some of the activities that were done until an attorney general ruling came in, would we see a budget savings at some point then from not having to pay a, you know, someone to go do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Klim, it's unlikely you would see a budget benefit, a large budget benefit from this. Even with having agents, volunteers assist us with the take operations, they're going to have to have that done under direct supervision of our staff with very close monitoring and management. The bill that you're speaking to has described that fairly well. And as we implement the use of volunteers, that will definitely help us control the cost of taking additional animals in those areas that need that. But I don't think it's going to reduce the cost of the department.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, that, okay, that, actually, that was kind of the crux why I was having difficulty understanding the issue relative to the budget. Because what I'm hearing is that you've got an increase in the population, that might be affecting a decrease in the prey herds, but that you're not asking for more FTE in order to manage the population. And so, what's that?
No, they would use volunteers.
No, well, but if you use volunteers, you don't expect that to be a decrease in your budget either because of the supervision that your folks will be having to use over the volunteers. So, what I don't understand, if there's even an answer for it, is how your budget is in any way relating to the management of the increased population.
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, I think the easiest way to say it is we believe that with the use of volunteers, we can control the increasing costs that are associated with this managing this program and the implementing the Cougar plan that the commission approved. Without that agent bill approved, then we are going to have increasing costs over time to deal with that. And so they're kind of a companion. There is going to be increasing manpower needs to manage these cougars. If we can use volunteers, which we use volunteers everywhere in the state for all kinds of things, if we can use them on this program as well, under our direction, we think we can control and manage those costs within what we've got in the governor's recommended budget. If we don't get the use of volunteers, then we're likely going to see increased costs to implement the Cougar Management Plan, or we're going to fail to succeed at meeting our management goals in that plan.
And then, my other, Madam Chair, if I might, it's also important for me because you list several different factors related to this, including human safety and livestock, big game predation. I assume you're talking about elk and deer. Anything else?
We're predominantly monitoring, Madam Chair, Senator Avakian, we're predominantly monitoring elk and deer. There is known mortality from cougars on bighorn sheep. And so most animals that are intersected with cougars can become prey.
Do you have any information as to how much the prioritization of those things relative to your need to manage the increased population? You've mentioned human safety a couple times, livestock damage obviously a problem. Where is the biggest problem that you need to address?
Madam Chair, Senator Avakian, I think it's pretty well spread across that. We've got some serious localized game herd issues that we're dealing with, and that is part of the plan where we have focused management activities in three different areas, and it's spread out equally across those. Obviously, human conflicts are of the utmost concern to us because of public safety issues, and we're going to stay on top of those. The predation issues on game herds, while very important to meeting our game herd management goals, are probably not as high as human. And livestock concerns are always important because of the partnership we have with landowners in terms of fish and wildlife management. So the answer is, I think they're fairly equally distributed, with human safety being on top. This gets to some of what we were just talking about, and that is that deer and elk populations, we have decreasing numbers identified as points of concern within our species management plan. Number of issues relative to that, but it revolves around black-tailed deer, mule deer, Rocky Mountain elk are the key species that we're monitoring very closely to look at issues associated with those. And we'll talk a little bit more, but we have disease issues, we have predation issues, we have habitat issues, and particularly in the east side with human population expansion into winter range areas for these animals. And all of those affect productivity and survivability of those herds. Another key issue is deferred maintenance. You'll see a budget item in there that looks at trying to get at deferred maintenance. We had a major evaluation done that showed that we had a little over $9 million in high priority projects among our hatcheries, offices, and wildlife management areas. Most of our facilities are old, with the exception of the headquarters office, which we lease. Most of our buildings, I think the newest one is 25 years old. And these aged structures require a lot of maintenance. They're not up to standard. The Charleston office is an example. When I visited that office, the staff all have little heaters under their desk because it gets cold in there. It's not well insulated. But they have to be careful not to turn the heater on in the bathroom when they walk in without turning one off somewhere else, or they blow the power supply because of the computer load. The electrical system is just not up to standard. And that's common throughout many of our offices as we've taxed them for current.
Virgil, I have a question about that. And in the presentation notebook, you mentioned about a outside consulting firm that did a report. I think it was before your time. But did the report, and it says that it ranked the number of projects by priority, did the report also look at consolidation? I mean, you know, facilities that were just beyond repair that needed to be closed? Or I realize that it's hard because everybody wants to have a hatchery in their area, and but, I mean, I've visited a lot of these hatcheries, and I've seen the incredible, you know, need for repair. And at what point do we say, okay, you know, we're just not going to be able to serve this area, or we need to do triage? Or do you know if that report also looked at, shaking her head, so.
No. Madam Chair, no, it did not. It is something, though, that we're looking at internally as we begin, you know, taking care of some of these highest priorities. Are there ways for us to gain efficiencies by consolidation? And we're not prepared at this time to recommend those. We will be working very diligently through this next biennium to find some of those efficiencies and make recommendations relative to that, particularly on facilities that have extremely high cost. And we're not going to gain a whole lot relative to public safety and other needs that may be associated with some of those. And there's a number of reasons to do that, particularly with hatcheries, from a water quality fish health standpoint. And we're going to look closely at that, but we're not prepared to do that at this time. Declining funding sources. This is a big one. We've heard some discussions and quite a bit about it over the last few months that you've been here. I focused on it with some of the committees when I first got here. And the bottom line is, as population has grown in this state, the proportion of the population that hunts and fishes and buys that license, which is our primary funding source, has changed significantly. This particular graph gives you some idea. The top line here are resident license sales over the last 30 years. And you can see that they fluctuate, but it's fairly static with a declining limb here in the recent past. Since 2001, in most of the western U.S., After 9/11, we've seen a decline in fishing license sales pretty much in most of the states, Montana being an exception. We've seen an uptick, and we're starting to see an uptick here, but there's a combination of drought effects, poor salmon fishing seasons, travel constraints. We're also, though, we see non-resident license sales are fairly static, but again, they show those same trends. This is fishing. So I would have to say it's very, very slowly declining with the most of it. Now, we do have ways to recruit and try to retain some of these. Hunting's another story. You see over this same 30-year period that hunting license sales for residents peaked in 1980. They declined and are still declining, and this is an aging population. We're simply dropping out of the sport as we get older, and we're not recruiting enough youngsters and new members to our state into this terrific sport. We do see an increasing number of non-residents. Many of the western states are seeing this. Oregon is one of the slower growing, and most of these are likely associated with family members coming back to hunt with their families that are in state. We're doing some demographic work on that to try to get a better handle on what's going on there. Bottom line, from a business standpoint, we have fewer customers or static customers that are going to have to pay the freight for expanding demand, or we're going to have to find new revenue sources to make that happen. This is a key issue for us as we go through this period. Other key issues that were key last biennium and are key again this is Diamond Lake. We spent about $5 million restoring Diamond Lake. The job's done. It's been successful. The fishery is rebuilding. And we're looking forward to an exciting fishery this summer and this fall with hopefully a fully restored fishery with all of its economic benefits and recreational benefits next year. But it still has, we still have a lot of responsibilities there for monitoring and evaluation relative to our NEPA documents that we went through with the Forest Service. So there's budget items relative to that. Some of the other key issues, we talk about the fact that we have declining or static user base out there, but they're using the resource more. One of the things we know from surveys is that the number of days fished, the number of days hunt by those who do go out is larger now than it used to be. They're spending more monies as individuals. And so the economic impact of the sport has increased and is continuing to increase. This data is from 2001. We have data coming in from 2006. It's just not ready yet. But over $2 billion were spent on Oregon-based fish and wildlife-based recreation, and that should say, and commercial fishing. The breakdown on that is wildlife viewing is just about $700 million. It's big spending. This is money people spend and related to trip. A lot of it's trip expenses. $600 million for fishing, sport fishing, $300 million for commercial, with $100 million of that is ex-vessel. The rest of it is economic spend. And $365 million for hunting in the state. We need better information, and we're going to have and work on getting localized information on economic benefits of hunting, fishing, wildlife viewing, and commercial fishing down to a county or an individual watershed. We're working on that now, and we're going to try to have that information available by the time we go for the next session.
Chair. Representative Plunk.
Yeah, just when you talk about, you know, some of the expenses related to the trip costs, and then on the other factor, declining since 2001. I don't know how many guys and or women that I talked to while I was going door to door that said, I just can't go out as much because of the gas prices. I mean, at least 30 or 40 times I'd find someone out in their front yard, you know, like at 3 p.m. on an afternoon. And I'd say, you know, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'd like to be fishing, but I just can't afford it. And, you know, in the middle of last summer.
Chair, Representative Plum, I appreciate that. Increased travel costs are a big part of what we think are causing people to choose not to go fishing. The other factor we find is time. We live in dual-income families. We live with complex time schedules. And people are choosing to spend their limited time other ways. We have a whole cadre of the tools available to us that have worked in other states for recruitment, direct mail, to get them to choose to use their limited time to take the kids and family fishing. And we're looking at doing some marketing in this next biennium We'd like to do more, but we don't have the budget for it. But we'll try to show that in Oregon that marketing can work here as it has in other states. Hopefully we can return $3 for every dollar invested based on some of the work that's been done.
Representative Gerard had a question.
Yeah. Virgil, in regard to the declining hunting licenses, is there do you do any kind of tracking, and is there a correlation between gun sales in Oregon and that declining license?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, no. We see gun sales are cyclic, and ammunition sales are cyclic. We saw a big jump in gun sales after 9/11 and ammunition sales. People stocked up, and then the next year it declined. And there are different social factors that do that. So there is a relationship of gun sales and sporting arms. Sales have been fairly static with these ups and downs, and ammunition sales being socially driven by factors bigger than hunting. The one thing we do get, though, is the federal excise tax on hunting equipment is 10%, I believe, 10 or 11%. And so we benefit. That goes into the federal trust fund that comes back to the states. We benefit from those gun and ammunition sales, whether they're hunting or not. And that comes back to us to be used. Another key issue, and we'll have some discussions of this in the budget, is fish and wildlife enforcement. We want to be sure that our fish and wildlife enforcement program presence is maintained and hopefully over time improved. We have seen a market the portion of the time that our agency pays for from the fish and wildlife program and state police is less than 50%, and it's in the mid-40s. I'd like to see that boosted to over 50% of the Oregon State Police's time being dedicated to the fish and wildlife enforcement that's funded by our agency. A good example of where we need additional funding for equipment, as well as population grows officers, is crab pots. The new rules on crab pot went into effect this last year, required some additional monitoring to be sure that the commercial fishermen were complying. We don't have a large ocean-going vessel that's capable of monitoring crab pots. Captain Marquis and his staff were able to talk the California and Washington folks into bringing their boat down at different times to do some enforcement work and have a presence out there that the commercial anglers were well aware of. And that presence is the deterrent that it takes to get the compliance needed. We need to have things like additional boats or money to at least charter boats to do enforcement work in this state.
Question about that. Is there any way to have some cooperative agreement with the Coast Guard?
Madam Chair, yes, there is, but the Coast Guard time is not as flexible as we need for some of our management needs, and we have management needs larger than they can meet relative to monitoring the commercial fishing. Our best efforts have been to work with charters or work with the adjacent states, but relying on them continuously puts us at the mercy of their time schedules. So the answer is yes to some degree, but not enough that the enforcement folks believe that's appropriate. And as we get into the budget discussions and enforcement, Captain Marquis can address those specifics. Other key issues, fish and wildlife diseases. We touched a little bit on that. They affect us a lot. We have growing concerns with fish and wildlife diseases in the state. Chronic wasting disease, while not documented in the state, is present around us. And we have put laws in place that keep from bringing in brain stem parts and brain tissues from animals taken out of state. But we need to continually monitor to be sure we don't have chronic wasting disease. Deer hair loss syndrome. This is black-tailed deer, and it's affecting the productivity and survivability of those herds. And it's one area that's caused by an exotic louse, and we need to do some more research to understand its impacts and what we can do to manage around that effect of deer loss syndrome. West Nile virus has made it to Oregon. It could be, it affects our birds. We know that it can have effect on sage grouse, which is a sensitive species. and we need to be monitoring and managing closely on that, because it's that particular sensitive species we've kept off of the endangered species list. But additional mortality from these kinds of factors without monitoring properly could trigger a reconsideration of listing on those. We have a number of fish health issues. The most current one is what's called IHN. It's infectious hematopoietic necrosis. That's why we call it IHN. And it's an internal kidney related disease that creates havoc, and it gets in the water supply above many of our anadromous hatcheries, and it limits the ability of us to use fish outside of those drainages that have been exposed to that infection, and it's spreading. It's endemic, but it's problematic from a water management standpoint. We have a ton of these types of issues out there that need continual management.
I think Representative Barrett has a question.
Virgil, we've had a lot of problems between Oregon and California with water temperatures and a lot of fish dying a couple of years ago. How does your agency work with other states in regarding to those type of crises?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, in that particular case, that was a temperature-related problem that resulted in an outbreak of a parasite or a disease that killed those salmon. We worked closely with the other states to sample and understand what's going on and see how those fish spread. The other thing we do is we issue permits for any out-of-state fish that may move across the borders. We require and have similar types of fish health guidelines among the states, and we contact and interact with our adjacent states to be sure that commercial transport of fish that may be coming from private hatcheries to a private source are properly done, and we monitor all of our sport and conservation fish work and manage those across the state lines with interjurisdictional committees.
Hello?
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Is that a budget impact item? And you may get to that further on, so I may be jumping ahead a little bit here. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerard, I don't believe we've got a major increase in fish health costs cranked in. We do have some increasing activities by our fish pathologist to do some things. There is a budget item in there that would, with the sturgeon permit that we're trying to get for commercial sturgeon, that would allow them to pay more of the cost of monitoring. In other words, their permit cost would actually cover the monitoring cost on private facilities. That is a small but real budget item. And as we move through to the next biennium, we're going to be looking at all our permits to see whether or not they're actually paying enough to support the monitoring we do. Currently, most of our private facilities don't pay sufficient funds to offset the cost of the monitoring that needs to be done. Other key issues, budget issues, are fish screening and passage. We've got over 400 prioritized fish screens that were done in the last 4 years. We've got 3,000 identified in the next 10 years. We have a lot of needs for technical assistance out there for landowners on this. We're trying to move and compensate for declining or variable federal funding that's been available for some of the fish screening. But this area is one that if we're going to achieve our recovery goals and keep fish off of listed, off of being listed, we're going to have more resources in this area. Ground fish management. We've had catastrophic declines and closures in ground fish, and by the National Marine Fisheries Service has closed those. We continue to provide the science and support for proper management direction in these arenas. We need more monitoring and work in that, and I believe that's reflected in our budget as well. The key issue, Oregon Hatchery Research Center. This is a facility the legislature approved funding a few years ago for. We've built that facility. It's in operation. It's been through shakedown. It's up, running, and functioning in its proper mode. It is a cooperative program primarily between us and Oregon State University. with Dr. Noakes heading that facility up. If you haven't seen it, I'd encourage you to get down there. But the demands for the use of the facility and the research that's being done there and is continuing, and we need to be sure that the proper funding there for inflationary purposes and to use the facility now that we've got the capital work done and are in place. And hopefully we'll get hatchery practices then that allow for the us to use our hatcheries properly and still do the conservation work that's important in the state. Another key issue, marine mammal predation. We have enhanced budgetary items somewhat to do more harassment of these animals, non-lethal. And we're looking at trying to get permits to have very limited lethal take. We just got our permit accepted by National Marine Fisheries Service. It's been published in the Federal Register. They're in the process of selecting a review committee to look at that. We're probably, if we're lucky, we'll get that approved this coming biennium. If we're not, it'll be the next biennium. Regardless of that, the harassment and hazing that we need to do to keep these few animals that are causing us problems from impacting our sensitive listed stocks has increased. We do have legislation introduced in Congress that would give us emergency authority to do some limited lethal take under Oregon and Washington's authority. That legislation died last session, but it's been reintroduced this session. We're not sure where that would go. If we were lucky enough to get that approved by Congress, it would immediately result in some additional work time associated with this. All kinds of fun critters that we're talking about that are key issues here. Wolves, we've got a good wolf issue. It's a really good document. Oregon has got that in place. We don't have any permanent pairs established in the state at this point. We're not even sure we have a permanent animal in existence in the state, although we've seen tracks and other signs of them. But expectations are we will likely, in this next biennium, get a permanent pair and pack going in the state, in the eastern part of the state. And we'll be on our way to recovery of this species under the recovery plan that we currently have. Our goal is to get them recovered and delisted as quickly as possible, which is likely to happen fairly fast, based on the experience that we've seen in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana. Those animals establish themselves very quickly.
No questions?
Well, one of them ate my cat last summer, so...
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. I know that the department introduced legislation, as it says here, to change statutes to implement the Wolf Conservation and Management Plan. Do you know what the status of that legislation is this session?
Mr. Chair, that legislation is struggling and is likely going to have a difficult time getting out of getting approved this session.
Still on the original committee?
I believe that's correct. Yes.
Yeah, and sitting in Ag and Natural Resources to move out before the deadline.
Okay.
Yes.
Actually, going back one to that, to the salmon predation with the sea lions. The statement here says that 100 California sea lions consume an average of 3,000 spring Chinook. Is that each, or is that total?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, that's total.
That's total.
Right. And these spring Chinook stocks are fairly sensitive, and depending on the timing and the nature of the run, that can be a fairly important number. When you look at the kinds of quotas that we've got for sport fishing and tribal fishing, that's a fairly significant number when you key in with some stocks. Everybody likes salmon.
Mr. Moore, you're getting by easily. I didn't think you'd get past wolves.
I'm zooming right through here. This is going good.
This is a budget.
But we could ask lots of questions about that wolf plan.
Okay. You have the grizzly introduction.
That one's at the very end of the program. I'll let Ron have that one. Chris, the chair.
That was 2 years ago.
Another key issue that we're going to be dedicating financial resources to is, and this is a state direction as well as an agency direction, is workforce enhancement. We've got to grow future leaders. Nationally, 77% of all of your fish and wildlife professionals in the nation are going to retire by 2015. We're a strong year class of baby boomers, and we're passing through, and we're leaving some holes behind us. You see that in almost any population management. You get strong year classes and then holes in there. We've got to be sure that we're training and recruiting and have the workforce that the public's going to expect. And that's going to require a commitment. It's not a large amount, but it's got to be consistent. We've got to be sure that the funds are there for professional development and training for every one of our staff, and that it's part of their work goals. And the commission is serious about this. I know the state is. It's an issue not just with our agency, but with all agencies as baby boomers pass through. But it's especially critical when much of wildlife management is an institutional memory. And as that memory passes, if we haven't mentored folks, it can be problematic. And so we're going to be expending valuable budget resources on training. Again, it's a small amount, but I want to make sure it's there every year. And we'll be developing those training programs individually as part of performance with supervisors. Some of the things we've done already, just to give you an example, is we're allowing more in-state attendance at professional society meetings, which had been cut back during some budget constraint periods, so that folks can get re-exposed to their peers. Legislation. We have four pieces of legislation out there. Many of you are aware of what those are. House Bill 241 is basically the commercial fishing permit board. It expands the board, a little bit additional cost whenever you expand a board for the administrative costs that are associated with that. It adds a developmental member and a restricted permit member to that commercial fish permit board. House Bill 2294. This is one that we're trying to recover costs for inspection and maintenance on fish screens. This is a good one for those that don't do it. If we go in and find that they haven't done it and we have to do that, that we can recover the cost of that. This is going to become more and more important as we get more fish screens out there to meet our recovery management needs. Senate Bill 240, this extends a program for landowner preference tags to address damage issues. This is a program we started some time back. We haven't had a chance to run it all the way through to see whether or not it's going to give the desired benefit. We need an extension of it. It's, I think, pretty much through the system at this point. House Bill 2295, again, this is the Wolf Bill, and it does not seem to be moving. It had three pieces. One was the general fund established for a compensation and the compensation items. It also designated wolf a game animal, or a game mammal in this particular case. We can implement our management plan without this bill, but it would be simpler if we had some of the clarification there, but it's not going to keep the commission's plan from being implemented. Budget criteria. These are fairly straightforward. We've got the statutory and core mission. These are items that are going to be played on as you hear the budget details coming up. We've got the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, which is a lot of OWEB funding, and we've got the Governor's Budget Development Principles. These are all built into the Governor's recommended budget. Budget criteria. One of the things that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife does that I think is excellent is an External Budget Advisory Committee. The acronym is EBAC. And this particular group works very closely with the department to look at our revenue, look at our spending, make recommendations on where the priorities are to assist the department in putting a budget together that we move through the commission and the governor's office. What we found in the budget prioritization process was that there were four items that the public always keyed on. They want their biologists. They want them, and they want more personnel in the field doing the service. Enforcement is always very important. It's common that you hear this from all levels. We need more enforcement. People see that. It's visible. It's tangible. Oops. Hit the button too quick. Hatchery operations. as you're aware of, for those of you who have hatcheries in your district, they're near and dear to our public. And landowner services is a growing demand area, particularly where we're working with volunteer programs throughout the state. These are areas the public wants us emphasizing in the budget, and our budget, I believe, reflects that appropriately. Budget drivers, we've talked a lot about some of these. Population demographics and preferences. Not only are we losing market share and asking those folks to carry the burden of spending in this agency, but we're seeing more and more non-game and wildlife viewing activities from folks that they're not paying to play type of thing. We're a user fee-based organization, and there's tremendous financial and economic benefits at $765 million annually for wildlife viewing. We have very little revenue from that. A few places like Savi Island, we have a parking fee. Other places, we get some revenue in. We get the check off on the income tax form, things like that. But nothing in relation to the doubling of population we've had in the last 30 years and the doubling we're going to have in the next 15 years. Other drivers, and we'll talk some more about the revenues, the fees, and our ending balances, and the enforcement efforts, water and land policy changes. Measure 37 is a huge driver here relative to our needing to work as those changes work through to be sure that the proper open lands stay open. And it's likely going to result in us as an agency having to look at those strategic places and maybe pay more than we have in the past to keep some of those important areas open. Mr. Chairman.
I'd back up for a moment. Regarding your comment about, I think the number was, well, roughly about $750 million in terms of economic impact of wildlife viewing and other associated activities. Obviously, sometimes when we talk about fishing and hunting, which we have licenses for, we clearly can identify what your role is in terms of management, what the role is in impact, in terms of impact. What is the impact you see from that type of usage, the viewing and other associated activities that the department has to pay attention to?
Mr. Chairman, the areas we've identified, and it's identified in our wildlife management area plans as well as the Oregon Conservation Strategy, facility development, information, educational materials, and interpretive staff, and being able to answer questions. So it really comes down to supporting the kinds of unique needs that wildlife viewers have relative to their activity versus the consumptive folks. They have some of those same needs, but the difference is they're contributing money into those programs, and where we can develop facilities that are useful for hunting and fishing, we can help the wildlife viewers, but they have some specific unique needs that aren't currently supported. And
would you say for the wildlife viewers that you have, you know, you're saying you have these increasing needs, but is there a public expectation from those parties that those needs should be met?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We see it in areas where we don't have adequate restrooms, and they go to the public wildlife management areas, and the next thing you know, they're beating on the door saying, I need kids to go to the potty, or they need facilities and support because these are publicly owned lands that they have access to, and when they go to them, they expect facilities to be there. And for that kind of wildlife viewing across all of the facilities we have in the state, we simply don't have the infrastructure developed. A few of them we do, but most of them do not. And many of those areas are in rural communities, and we can move a lot of this wildlife viewing travel money and the money they spend, that $750 million, into rural areas if we develop some of the infrastructure to support that.
Thank you. Yes,
Senator Nelson. It seems hard, though. How are you going to collect fees from those folks?
Like in Savi's Island, there's a parking.
I walk out in the country sometimes, and I've had a deer go by. It's pretty cool. I like that. Oh, he's going to charge me a viewer fee for really getting some enjoyment out of it. I mean,
Mr. Chairman,
it's different than hunting. You know, I go out there and I hunt that deer, you're going to charge me a fee for it.
Senator Nelson, that is one of the big challenges that we have, is how do we use our user fee-based strategy, those who benefit pay, on a generalized activity like you just described. There's a lot of models out there. Many states are looking at some way to get a dedicated portion of the general fund or some new funding that is appropriated through some mechanism to dedicate to that kind of activity. Missouri has the best one of those, or I wouldn't say the best, the longest and the largest. But it's based on a 1/8 of 1% sales tax, obviously something Oregon doesn't have. But there are other models out there that have been used, and there's a number of states that have that. There's been attempts at the federal level to get a similar type of trust fund established like we have for fish and wildlife through the federal aid program that would then come back to the states. Those have failed in the recent last 10 or 12 years, and it doesn't look like, given the federal budget priorities, that's going to succeed. So we're working on that, and we have a group of conservation groups that are working diligently to look at what is possible and feasible in Oregon. We're just not ready to bring anything like that forward yet. So this gets us finally into some of the numbers, and this is where I'm going to have to start getting staff help quickly. On page 16 and 17 of your book, as well, is the corresponding pages for the graphics that we're going to show here. The governor's recommended budget is $283 million approximately. The pie is kind of ugly with a lot of different pieces to it, and many of these are, this is our revenue that we expect relative to the 07-09 budget, and you can see the shape of the pies. One of the things I will point out is this is other funds, but other funds also include license fees and some of the beginning balance funds that are in here. And so this piece of the pie, and you'll see this in another view, but I wanted you to clearly see where license fees were in here, that they're about 27% of our budget in terms of the revenue that we generate. And we'll talk some about this beginning balance. While it looks large, it has very little flexibility associated with it. Lottery funds are primarily coming to us from OWEB for our portion of the implementation of the Oregon plan. General funds, 6%, and then federal funds is a huge piece of the pie here. Expenditures?
Effectively saying your beginning fund balance is already dedicated in many cases to whatever the original funding source it came from.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and I'll go into a little bit of detail on that here in just a moment. Our expenditures, this shows the pie here with all of the different programs. Many of them are statutory. In other words, we have to have these programs based on some statutory requirement that we have, and so the pie is divided up that way. I believe an easier way to look at this pie is by the program, Fish, Wildlife, Enforcement, Administration, and Capital Investment. Those are some of the key drivers we were talking about, and we can go back and forth between these pies. But fish is the big piece of the pie. The bulk of the agency is fish, commercial fish, sport fish, hatcheries, our management and conservation programs. Wildlife, as you would hope and expect, is the second largest piece of that pie. And enforcement comes in at 5%. Our capital investment is the $5.5 million. That's a small but important key to getting this backlog of capital improvements taken care of. And the table on page 19, I believe, is the in your handout is the same table we're working from here. This particular table gives you some ending balance projections and gets a little bit more into that. We've got a beginning balance of $33 million. That's what we're carrying over in that beginning balance. We project a license revenue of $77 million. Non-license revenue of 36, total revenues of $146 million. Other fund expenditures, 121, 25. The bottom line, our ending balance is 21. million dollars. And I want to focus down here on this bottom ending balance elements. The dedicated and obligated portion of that ending balance. These are special pots of money that have been set aside and we can't use flexibly beyond that particular program is $14 million. It's the biggest chunk of that 21. We have set aside $3 million for expected COLA that'll come down through whatever action, legislative and union negotiation actions. We need about $2 million in operating revenues just to make payroll every month. And so we've got to keep that amount of balance in there. It's just, you know, checking account has to have that. And because of that $110 million of federal funds, we often have contracts that result in us funding things with our own money before we get reimbursed. You know, it's just like any business. And so consequently, we need a minimum of $2.2 million just to stay solvent with the federal fund reimbursement process. That ends up being $21.4 million, and this is about as skinny as we can get it and stay solvent relative to the operations in the agency. It's getting down to the point that we don't have much free fund balance left. That's not unexpected. We're in, by the end of this biennium, we'll have been 6 years since the last fee increase. Typically, the way our organization operates is the legislature approves a fee increase. It goes up a big amount, and then we put that money aside in our free fund, and our beginning balance, free fund balance, is high at that point. And then we, about halfway through, we begin spending that, and our revenues aren't sufficient to support the programs, which is where we're at right now. Our revenues don't support our program. We're having to use up some of our free fund balance, and we're going to spend it down to this level to where we're just basically solvent at the end of this biennium. We'll have to have a fee increase in the next biennium, or we'll have to begin cutting programs. We can't cut. We don't have enough free fund balance to it, and that's not unexpected. That's the norm for a Fish and Wildlife agency that operates with occasional fee increases versus small incremental increases over time. Some of the changes we've got: the governor's recommended budget has an $18.1 million general fund. That's a big increase, 69%. That's $7.4 million, but it's driven primarily by a reversal of one-time fund changes. Remember, we had, and I think I've got this right, a fee increase. We had a general fund that was hit hard because of the economic downturn. We had the money in our budget to pick up some of that general fund, and we did in the last biennium. We need to reverse those charges now that the general revenues are a little better, and we're at the end of our revenue string for our fee, and we're trying to recover some of that and get back to where we were in the 2003-2005 biennium when those charges were first put in there. Expenditure changes in the lottery fund, about a 14% increase, about $1 million. And there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in that one, but Hatchery Research Center phasing in, reversals, policy packages, and we'll talk more about those a little later. Other funds. This is predominantly licensed, so there's very little increase in other funds. $3.4 million, 3%. Again, it's a lot of some policy package changes, a lot of budget adjustments back and forth. If you look on page 20, let's see, expenditures, page 20, it gives a shopping list there of some of the items that we're going to be, that affect that other fund. Moving monies around from one time. We've got the Western Oregon Stream Restoration Project and Settlement Agreement for Fish Mitigation as a policy package that's added in. Other expenditure changes, a fairly good jump in federal funds, $14.6 million, about 15%. Again, On page 20, it lists some of the changes that are there. Much of this is inflationary and other changes associated with operating the large mitigation hatchery facilities and other mitigation programs in the federal budget.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay. I have a question about the other funds expenditures. And, Virgil, can you remind me, and I know we talked about this last session, you weren't here, about sale of the Portland headquarters and what happened to those funding, those funds that it went towards. I know you're not purchased your new building, you're actually leasing it, so can you explain for the committee?
I'm going to probably need to defer to staff on that. I know that we had to use some of those funds to furnish the building we're in now, and that there was some adjustments, but I understand they're all properly accounted for at this point. But Lori, can you?
Sure. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly, Deputy Director of Administration at the Department. Chair Devlin, Representative Dingfelder. In the back of that presentation notebook under tab 7, we actually included a page, because this question came up back in January when we came before you, that kind of summarizes the whole headquarters process, when we made the change, what we received from the building as far as proceeds, what the expenditures were. And then I believe your question you have is about the remainder of those sale proceeds at the end. We had to pass legislation to get those dollars made available to us as far as expenditures, because the Fed said we would have problems if we diverted those funds back to the general fund, since federal funds had been used to purchase that headquarters building. So we got the remaining revenue back in, and we've used those as part of our budget. They ended up in our balance.
So that is, just a follow-up, so that is accounted for then in the 0709 under the wildlife fund. That money is then part of the ending balance?
Chair Devlin, Representative Dingfelder. It's part of our beginning balance. And so it just went to support programs. I don't have it broken out as to what it specifically went to. It's just part of the big pot of money on the other fund side of the equation.
Clarification on the new building in Salem. Is that a lease or a lease purchase, or is it a...
Chair Devlin, it's a lease. We had an initial five-year lease with a renewal for the next 5 years built into that original lease. We will be very likely talking about that lease process during this calendar year sometime to get that resolved. I believe when the agency initially entertained the move down here, there was some discussion about at some point being a building might be available in the mall for the agency to move into, but I don't believe that's going to happen in the near future. So it's very likely we'll renew that lease for another 5 years.
What's the annual cost of the lease?
I don't have that with me, Chair Devlin, but we'll bring it back tomorrow.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I might, I know in the past it's turned out cheaper per square foot than the DAS rate to rent the building they're in right now than DAS would through the universal rent charge. I don't know if that still holds true for 0709 biennium, but I know it is true for the current biennium.
Please proceed.
Okay, we're getting close to the end here. I think we're going to get you out of here on schedule. We have a number of benchmarks. I'm just now becoming familiar with the numbering system and what they are. But I'm going to whip through three of them here, and they're all very similar. It's basically the percent of monitored species that are not at risk, and they're associated with freshwater fish. They're associated with marine species that are not at risk, and they're associated with terrestrial species that are not at risk, plants and vertebrates and vertebrates in this particular case. And those are our major benchmarks that we monitor over time. The other benchmarks, that this is a new one that we're dealing with, and it's the percent of land in Oregon that is in a natural habitat, and it's classified in four different categories: forest, shrubland, grassland, and wetland and riparian. This is good. This is a good benchmark, because habitat is key to most of the needs of these species. And if we can monitor those key habitats and how these important habitat components are, we can also get at how things are likely to stack up on these species. The percent listed and not listed, the trigger on that is black and white. You don't, and we often don't see a change in that. And then it just happens, and you get one. And so we try to keep them from being listed, but the key component on listing in many, many of the cases is the habitat. and this is a good one. Some other things we're doing are efficiencies that we're looking at to try to reduce the demands on the budget. And there's a whole litany of these things. Technology is a big one. And we talk a lot about technology, but it's really how to do business more efficiently. And then we try to make it electronic. It's mostly looking at business applications, but there's also some data applications, field data loggers, information that's put in electronically in the field and transferred same day, same time, that gets into databases faster. Our staff and technicians can utilize that information to come up with management needs better. One of the things that we're also looking at is our field offices. I was surprised to see when I got here that many of our field offices did not have high-speed internet capability. Many of our electronic forms and processes and information require that. They couldn't even get on the internet. They're using dial-up, and in some of these remote locations, the dial-ups were so slow you could turn it on at night, get up the next morning, and your email package might be there. And these are hatcheries, wildlife management areas that are out in sticks. We've gone to satellite technology. We're getting those up and running. Now those folks are real-time interactive with our business and information systems that are out there. It was expensive, but the cost-benefit of getting those remote staff part of the circle, that's what makes our agency a little different, is we have a lot of staff out there in the sticks or in areas that don't have the kind of infrastructure we would in a more populated area. And we're...
I think at this point we'll probably finish up for today. And Mr. Siebert, you had some suggestions for tomorrow.
I just wanted to make sure. It seems that in the notebook, at least, we just skipped over the performance measures a little bit, so we'll be going back to that at a later point.
Can I respond? Chair Devlin, Mr. Siebert, the plan was for the performance measure piece to actually use the forms in the book rather than try to put those on the slide. So I was planning on covering those in more detail once Mr. Morris completed his presentation. That was pretty much our next step. So if that works?
Yeah, that should be fine.
I'll pick that up tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll take that tomorrow. We'll take a few minutes and finish up.
Okay. Committee, we actually have ODFW, I believe, scheduled for 6 days in total, including the day for public testimony. And the co-chairs have wanted us actually to delay work sessions, so that's why you're not seeing state parks until we get through with all the presentations for budgets. So we'll start having work sessions next week. In fact, we could have literally three of them potentially next week. Maybe not three. Let me think. Parks, ODFW. Close. 2 to 3. 2 to 3. But with that, we will adjourn for today. I'll close the public hearing, and we'll start again at 8:30 tomorrow morning.